Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Welcome to episode 39 of our Planet Earth series, in which we look at our home planet. Our first item is how the Hubble Space Telescope was able to detect signs of life on Earth by looking at the Moon during a lunar eclipse.
Taking advantage of the total lunar eclipse of January 2019, astronomers, using NASA's Hubble Space Telescope, have detected ozone in Earth's atmosphere. In this observation, Hubble did not look at Earth directly. Instead, astronomers used the Moon as a mirror to reflect sunlight that passed through Earth's atmosphere. This method serves as a proxy for how they will observe planets around other stars in search for worlds similar to our own. Though numerous ground-based observations of this kind have been done previously, this is the first time ultraviolet light passing through Earth's atmosphere was observed from space. The measurements from this experiment detected the strong spectral fingerprint of ozone. On Earth, photosynthesis over billions of years is responsible for our planet's high oxygen levels and thick ozone layer. That's one reason why scientists think ozone or oxygen could be a sign of life on another planet. But finding ozone on distant worlds isn't an easy task. Ultraviolet observations like this can best be conducted from space telescopes above the limiting effects of looking through Earth's skies because ozone blocks most ultraviolet light from beyond the atmosphere. One of NASA's major goals is to identify habitable and inhabited planets. But how would we know whether a distant planet has ozone or not? The atmospheres of some extrasolar planets can be probed if that distant world passes across the face of its parent star, called a transit. During a transit, starlight filters through the backlit exoplanet's atmosphere. Chemicals in the atmosphere leave their telltale signature by filtering out certain colors of starlight. Astronomers have used Hubble to observe the atmospheres of several gas giant planets that transit their stars, but terrestrial planets are much smaller objects and their atmosphere thinner, like the skin on an apple. Therefore, teasing out these signatures is much more difficult. To prepare for future studies with larger telescopes, astronomers used Hubble to conduct experiments on a much closer and only known inhabited terrestrial planet, Earth. Our planet's perfect alignment with the Sun and Moon during a total lunar eclipse mimics the geometry of a transiting terrestrial planet with its star. But the observations were also challenging because the Moon is very bright, and its surface is not a perfect reflector because it is mottled with bright and dark areas. The Moon is also so close to Earth that it appears to move very quickly in the sky, making it harder for Hubble to stay pointed at the same location. However, in spite of the challenges, the experiment was an incredible success, and Hubble is supporting the ongoing quest to find planets that are similar to our own, and perhaps, one day, find signs of life on other worlds.
Who would have thought the Hubble Space Telescope showing us signs of life on Earth?
Planet Earth is blue.
It is now 2.5 years since the devastating Australian bushfires of 2019 and 2020 summer. They sent far-reaching plumes of smoke into the atmosphere that worsened air quality over the eastern states and as far afield as New Zealand and even South America. Predicting where bushfire smoke will travel and how bad the air will be downwind is a challenge, but Earth-observing satellites can help. Among them are NASA's Terra and CloudSat. Another is Calypso, the Cloud Aerosol and Infrared Pathfinder Satellite Observation. The United States' National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration operates the SUOMI satellite. Together, the instruments on these satellites provide glimpses at the smoke over time, which can help improve air quality predictions. The satellite instruments have the advantage of providing broad coverage and consistent measurement accuracy. An additional advantage is that they make their observations without any risk to the people taking the data. One of the instruments on the Terra satellite is the multi-angle imaging spectroradiometer. This has 9 different cameras pointing toward Earth at different angles. This allowed Terra to collect snapshots of the smoke plumes from different angles. Scientists were able to look at those different perspectives to calculate the extent and height of the smoke plumes, both downwind and nearest the source of the fire. Many of the plumes went more than 4 kilometres into the air. This put them above the boundary layer of the atmosphere, and this is the layer of atmosphere nearest the Earth's surface. Now, smoke tends to stay aloft longer, travel further, and have a larger environmental impact if it is injected higher in the atmosphere. Terra's spectroradiometer also collected information about the amount, size, and brightness of the particles within the smoke plume. They did this based on how particles scatter light at different angles and wavelengths. This data gave researchers information about the characteristics of the bushfire smoke in order to predict how it would move and affect air quality. The intensely burning parts of the fires released mostly small, dark particles. As the plumes moved downwind, the particles became larger and brighter. This is possibly because water and other gases emitted by the fires condensed on the smoke particles. Well, expectations are high for the GOES-18 satellite, GOES, which is Geostationary Operational Environmental Satellite. And that's because of its ability of its predecessors to detect bushfires. This feature from the Goddard Space Flight Center.
The 2020 Western U.S. wildfire season was historic, both for the record 59,000 wildfires that formed and the 10.1 million acres they scorched. But right on its heels was 2021, in which nearly 52,300 fires were recorded, with more than 7.8 million acres burned through December 24th of that year. Since launching in 2016, NOAA's most advanced geostationary satellites are improving fire weather forecasts, wildfire detection, and fire hazard tracking in near real time. With lives and property at stake, timely, high-quality data is critical for firefighting efforts on the ground. NOAA's GOES-17, operating in the GOES West orbit, has shown its mettle, detecting and monitoring wildfires and the hazardous smoke they emit.
There's two instruments on the GOES series of satellites which are helpful for wildfire detection and monitoring. The first is the Advanced Baseline Imager, or the ABI. We're able to detect hotspots from the thermal signatures from the fires, and we're also able to detect the smoke and track the smoke with time in order to issue notifications and warnings to the public. The second instrument is called the Geostationary Lightning Mapper, or the GLM. GLM is important because oftentimes lightning is the cause of the start of wildfires. And so forecasters can monitor the GLM to see where lightning has occurred to decide whether or not they think some lightning may have started a fire.
But a new satellite called GOES-T is poised to replace GOES-17 in the GOES West position. Once it reaches orbit, GOES-T will be renamed GOES-18, and it will provide the same sophisticated technology to track wildfires in the western U.S., as well as detect lightning that can ignite a wildfire in parched vegetation.
This current capability of GOES is the fact that we can do rapid scans, higher resolution with higher sensitivity, and include things for the first time like lightning mapper and the ABI instruments. I don't think we could imagine not having GOES capability. We absolutely need it.
The National Interagency Fire Center is the nation's support center for wildland firefighting.
GOES is an eye in the sky. It's giving us a hemispheric perspective with GOES 16 and 17. Without having those two satellites up there constantly staring, constantly monitoring, constantly providing us with information, we really have just a big gap. We would lose a lot of our capability to understand the environment, to see the interaction of the fires with the atmosphere, and see how the atmosphere is impacting the behavior of the fires. with those being able to look at the United States every 5 to 10 minutes, we're getting a much more real-time appreciation for how fires are behaving because of the ability of the GOES satellites to detect the heat from the fires.
When bushfires engulf our countryside, the sky can turn an apocalyptic shade of burnt orange. In other areas, the sky is a hazy grey, and flecks of ash float through the air. Further away, the sky looks relatively normal. And that does not mean that there are no smoke particles in the air. There may be too few smoke particles for our eyes to detect. One satellite has been able to measure smoke in apparently clear skies. This satellite is Calypso, the Cloud Aerosol LiDAR and Infrared Pathfinder Satellite Observation. It has a laser aboard that shoots bursts of light towards the Earth. When that light hits something, such as smoke particles, it is reflected back to sensors on Calypso. Even smoke that is too thin for human eyes to see can be detected by the LiDAR. Calypso is not only able to measure how much smoke is present, it can also reveal how high it is. Calypso can tell the difference between clouds and smoke. This can sometimes be hard to do by looking at a satellite image. Knowing where the smoke is in relation to clouds allows researchers to see the interaction between clouds and smoke. This can affect the characteristics and spread of the smoke. For example, sometimes clouds ingest and modify smoke particles. They can remove smoke from the air when it rains. Other times, dark bushfire smoke particles can absorb sunlight, becoming warm and heating the atmosphere, which can cause clouds to evaporate. One disadvantage of Calypso is that it sees only a narrow swath below it and generally passes over any given place no more than once a day.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
Now, have you ever wondered how we detect life underground? Well, Stephen Giovannini has detected the deepest underground life that has ever been discovered.
Earth, sky.
There are still frontiers out there being explored, and it's very exciting to be working at one of these frontiers because you never know what you're going to find, and we certainly were surprised by what we encountered.
You're listening to microbiologist Stephen Giovannini of Oregon State University, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Dr. Giovannini led a team that in late 2010 discovered living creatures, bacteria, over a kilometer below the ocean floor in the North Atlantic. He spoke about the findings with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
So tell us, what are the main findings of your investigation of life at the deepest layers of Earth's crust?
Well, this expedition investigated microbial life in gabbros, which are rocks in the deep part of the ocean crust, and discovered bacteria there. And it was known that there are bacteria in these rocks. The rocks are cracked, and the ocean circulates through this this rock crust. But no one had ever gotten into this deep layer of the Earth's crust before and looked at what was there. We weren't that surprised to find organisms there because the temperatures were about right, and we knew there was water there. The big surprise was the type of bacteria we found. They weren't the same ones that are found in the basalts above. They were an entirely different group of microorganisms. The interesting thing about this discovery was that the organisms we found down there were normally associated with degrading hydrocarbons, and the bacteria in the rocks above are quite different, not associated with that kind of activity. So the bacteria that we found down there were closely related to organisms that are normally found in oil reservoirs or methane deposits. That was a surprise, but it turns out that there's an explanation for this, that other scientists associated with this expedition and also working at a nearby and very exciting area called the Lost City Hydrothermal Vent have reported that hydrocarbons are in this area, in this region, are being formed abiotically. And that means that, essentially carbon and hydrogen molecules are being made from carbon dioxide and hydrogen in interactions between water and rock and producing organic matter. Now, most of your listeners will know that the organic matter in the part of the biosphere that we're used to all comes from photosynthesis. So it strongly appears that in this region of the Earth's crust, at least, you've got abiotic synthesis of organic matter occurring, and that the microbial community we encountered is using that material as a source of nutrients for growth.
Oil methane is being created deep in the ocean, through the decomposition of plant life. It's actually being created from kind of like the raw ingredients, carbon dioxide, hydrogen, water. Do I have this right?
Yeah, well, you have it right, that that's the best hypothesis at the moment that we have. So that has a lot of implications. First of all, it says that this community of microorganisms far below the seafloor may be subsisting on materials that are not derived from photosynthesis at the surface. So they may be truly independent of the surface biosphere. Secondly, it has implications for understanding what life might be like on other planets. And the planet that everybody is most interested in, of course, is Mars. Because it's known that there's water on Mars, and it's known that Mars is producing methane, and it's a bit of a mystery where that methane comes from. So one possibility is that it's being produced by abiotic processes like this. Enough is known about Mars to postulate that if there is life there, it's probably some sort of subterranean life occurring in rocks very much like the rocks that we were investigating at the Atlantic Massif.
And you mentioned that the conditions there were just right there was really no surprise, as you said, to find life down there because of the conditions. What are those conditions like?
Well, there's a lot of rock and a little bit of water circulating through cracks. It's not that hot. It's a balmy temperature. I think you and I'd be happy at the temperature that most of these rocks were collected at. There's the concentrations of nutrients for growth are very low, and the concentrations of cells are quite low too. But there are traces. I don't know what it would smell like if you could sniff it, but there are certainly traces of hydrocarbons in the water. And though, as I say, those appear to be derived from interactions between carbon dioxide, water, and rock.
Tell us more. Why are scientists looking for life in some of the deepest places that have ever been drilled into the Earth?
The desire to understand the microbiology of these igneous subsurface crustal rocks is motivated by a number of different curiosities that humans have. One is these rocks certainly are similar to the kinds of rocks found on planets like Mars, and so one wonders whether similar processes could be, whether you could find out about what's happening in the deep Earth subsurface and whether similar processes might be happening elsewhere in the solar system. I think that's a very legitimate curiosity that motivates this sort of research. Secondly, today, we're very concerned and interested in how the climate and chemistry of our planet was formed. And this interaction of seawater with crustal rocks is a very important long-term process that has transformed the chemistry of seawater and continues to alter seawater chemistry. So, and it's massive in scale. I mean, the size of the Earth's crust is enormous, and the water, the oceans are constantly circulating through that crust. So even if it's a very dilute process, releasing energy and slightly altering the chemistry of the seawater, it's happening on such an immense scale that it's something that humans ought to know more about, I think.
And so what's next? Where will this research lead to? You said that it's not easy to do this, and it may not happen maybe for another expedition like what the IODP did. May not happen for a while. Are there plans to seek life further down?
Well, there's certainly a lot of planning going on, and there are no plans on the table at the moment to resample this environment. It's going to take a few years to mount another expedition of this scale to go back, and I'm not sure that they would go back to this part of the crust. They might choose to sample another region.
You've been listening to Stephen Giovannani, a professor of microbiology at Oregon State University in Corvallis. To subscribe to this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Planet Earth is blue.